Welcome to the No Film School podcast. This is Gigi Hawkins, and today we have a special episode drop live from NAB 2024. Well, pre-recorded, but live recorded on the ground at NAB, an interview led by our tech editor and writer at No Film School, Jordan Aldridge. And today, Jordan speaks with Grant Petty, the CEO of Blackmagic, and they talk about the Blackmagic URSA Cine 12K, the box style Blackmagic PYXIS 6K, and Grant gives us his thoughts on the future of AI and video. Here's our interview.
All right, this is Jordan with No Film School, sitting here at NAB 2024 at the Blackmagic booth with CEO of Blackmagic Design, Grant Petty. How are you doing, Grant?
Good, how are you?
Thanks for having us. Yeah, so this is our first stop here for NAB. Fitting, you guys just made some major announcements to kick the festival off. I want to talk about a lot of things, but the Blackmagic URSA Cine 12K.
Yep.
Tell us about that camera and kind of, I think you called it your dreams high-end cinema camera in your presentation. Yeah. What makes it your dream camera?
Well, in some ways, I think you could probably see camera development as being the sensor development can sometimes be separate to the body. And so we had this sort of sensor development process going along. But in the earlier days, we had this idea that the URSA Mini Pro would be kind of almost a cinema camera with broadcast features on it. But we didn't really have the broadcast connections for the cinema accessory connections. Yeah, we had to kind of compromise in some ways. And I think we did very well with that. But obviously, when the 12K sensor came along, that was a really huge step in technology and quality. And that body just wasn't right for it. So, yeah, we knew we were starting to sort of develop a new body. And we just went for it. We thought, well, let's not think about, because we have always thought, it's always been on our mind to make things affordable. You don't want to make things unaffordable. We're definitely working hard on that. But sometimes you just got to do the technology you've got to do, and when we looked at what we wanted to do with that product, and it was like, let's just go for it and have everything we wanted. So, and all the little things we'd learned, like even the buttons, they're quiet. When you push them, the early buttons would make a small click sound and you can hear that. So just little tiny things. But also one of the big things we want to do is I felt like we had a lot of restrictions on the memory media cards all the time. And these media cards have got to be done to a standard. They've got to be high volume because they've got to go into small consumer products. Well, that's kind of a problem. So what happens if we just break through that and build a cloud store in the camera? So that's why we released the cloud stores. The original reason for that was we want to develop that technology, get it out as a separate product. And essentially, in some ways, the cloud store mini is the same thing that's in the camera. And in fact, in one point, I was thinking, maybe you don't even need to remove the module because you could just clear it through Fast10G Ethernet or whatever. But then it's like, no, you need to remove it so you can just swap out the magazines, essentially. But that kind of, it's like everything we could possibly, we try to break every barrier that existed in some ways. And that would take us sort of fairly well beyond anything. And it kind of wound up here, and in fact, a lot of the work was even the accessories that come with it. The shoulder mounts and the viewfinder had to be redone. All the way that was mounted and all the adjustability and all of that. So it became a bit of a bigger project than we thought it would be, but we're kind of pretty happy with the result,
Yeah. How long ago did y'all start on it,
It was a few years ago, and it takes a fair bit of engineering time. Cameras aren't, they're complex products to build in general. So, and that one was a real, it's a very complex product. But again, if you want to hit that top end, and my feeling was that it's not just the sensor technology, the workflow and Blackmagic Cloud and all these sorts of things. So you can see it all kind of coming together. Even the fact that the camera does live streaming, so a client could watch a shoot and things like that. Because again, it's the post-production side of it. I'm from post-production, so I'm always thinking about what's the consequences of what you're shooting? What are you going to do downstream? And it's not just about delivering. You can deliver a product at low cost, but it's like the space shuttle, remember? They delivered it at a low cost, but the ongoing running cost was very high. And I feel like that's one of the problems with shoots. You've got strange file formats. Sometimes you've got audio guys that record separate audio and you've got to sound sync everything, all this complex stuff. So you want to put things in DaVinci to help solve some of that. You want to try and organize. Like the audio in URSA Cine is very, very good. In fact, the audio in the studio cameras is good. So you potentially can just plug the microphones into there and just record it. You don't really need a separate audio recorder. So the audio is in the files. So just all this kind of stuff. It's really thinking about the entire post-production process all the way to the client. not even to the post people, but all the way through to the client. The client could watch the shoot, you know, and so, yeah, it's pretty exciting, you know.
Nice. I know a lot of our audience is kind of like small production companies or people, indie shooters that kind of have their own gear. Where do you see the new, if they're Blackmagic fans and they use Blackmagic cameras, what do you see as like their new A cam, B cam, C cam kind of options that you would recommend?
It kind of depends what kind of shoot they're doing. A good example with the Pixis and the cinema camera is they were kind of designed at the same time. They're different form factors. So the question is, where are you shooting? A lot of people go in and don't get permission anymore. They just roll into an alley or some, and they you know, you're going to use the cinema camera for that because it's in that body and you just roll up, start shooting. But you can do that with Pixis. But once the camera starts looking a bit rigged, people start getting suspicious. I remember once I was in a market and I was just test shooting, and the guy at the chicken thing that sells chicken meat said, oh, have you got permission to do that? I'm like, this guy cuts up meat for a living. I'm not going to say no. So I just bullshit and said, oh, of course, you know, the people in the office, oh, okay. And he kind of just stared at me the whole time. But markets look great. It's a great place to test a camera, but there's some scary people in there. So I think it comes down to what are you shooting? Like if you're shooting something sturdy, very street level, kind of, you know, very kind of youthful, then that's much more of a roll up than the cinema camera and the Pixis are designed to be absolutely interchangeable. I mean, all our cameras have got similar color science, but if you're rolling up with the 12K camera, like, you know, the Ursa Mini, you could say that the Ursa Mini Pro 12K is a B camera in that case. Mm-hmm. I guess it depends how B do you want it. My hope is that you can actually afford to have multiple Ursa Minis or even actually have, like, you could hire a couple in if you're doing something bigger.
Right.
But maybe own one. It's hard to tell, you know. So, I mean, they all kind of mix.
Yeah.
My thinking is probably more, instead of, I guess maybe a better way to explain that, I'm not doing a good job of explaining this because I haven't really thought about that too much, but if the color sciences, we can get them all to grade together really nicely, then really it's, instead of it being an A and B camera, it's more like, well, how do you need to shoot the B camera? And that would probably define the design you need. It's like, okay, well, it's got to be small, but I want it rigged, so I'd use a Pixis, or I've got to handhold it, or I'm going to put it in a some kind of rig or in a car or something like that. So it probably actually comes down to what is the B camera situation, and you'd pick a design that would work in that. So it's not, it really just comes down to what are you shooting, and so that's probably why I'm having a struggle a bit to answer that, because I'm not quite sure. You could be doing something in a car and you got something mounted on the car. Well, that might dictate what kind of camera. That might be a lot better. Or it could be another Ursa Cine. It's hard to tell. So
no, that's fair.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of our readers kind of start with like a Blackmagic Pocket 4K or something.
Yeah,
and then they kind of like graduate upwards as they get bigger jobs.
It's a good way
and
to
they
do
kind
it.
Of need more.
Like you can try it no risk in some ways. Like even Blackmagic Camera on the iPhone, that's free. Give that a try.
Yeah.
Learn some of the functionality. Okay, now I might migrate to something or maybe not. It might be fine. Like, it's hard to tell. You know, like, I think I like the fact that Blackmagic Camera gives you a zero-cost option to get into cinematography. Then you can work your way up from there. And so I've always been, my theory is I came into this industry as a customer, which is why we always look a bit weird. People never really understood quite what our motivations are. I'm a customer. I'm from post-production. And I just used to be somewhat horrified by the manufacturers. They just don't, like, a lot of the sales guys love selling big things at low volume. It's less work, more margin. And all the people on this show floor, they're all got incentive. If they don't sell stuff, and they all do chanting and stuff before the show, it's really creepy. And because they get commission.
Right.
So they need to sell things. We don't give commission to anyone of our people. It's like, let's just communicate what we do. If people buy it, they buy it. If they don't, they don't. It's like people have a time frame in their own lives of what they buy and when and what's suitable. So now we hope we could sell something, but really we don't want to be dependent on that. So my feeling has always been that I want more people in industry. When I came into this, I remember literally the first show. Remember the first show we worked together? A guy from a popular NLE come up to me and said, oh, so what are you guys going to do when we kill you? I'm like, well, what do you mean? Well, we're bigger than you. We're just going to kill you. I'm like, oh my God. So I go and I rebuild manufacturing. Well, I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
They're still around kind of, but I go back. I'm like, oh my God, they're going to get killed. Another guy from another large Japanese manufacturer ran up and took a photo of our product with his camera. And ran off and thought, oh my God, they're all going to kill us. I've got to like get really better at manufacturing. I've got to like get better at marketing and go back and I'm killing myself over the following year. When I come back the next year, I'm like, I think we're okay. I think we're going to be able to take whatever they've thrown at us. And it's like, nothing happened. I'm like, what's going on? And a local distributor's like, don't be an idiot. There's just some sales guy giving you shit. And I'm like, really? Like, is that a thing? I didn't even know how that worked. I didn't know that that's a thing. Like, that's apparently a completely normal thing. I didn't know any of that worked. I'm just like, I'm a customer. I thought what people said was real. So I've gone and done all this manufacturing stuff, but now I'm suddenly able to make things lower cost. Because what I was trying to do right from the very start is bring more people into the industry. I've always felt that the industry could just be big. I don't have to compete with anyone. What I've got to do is get more people in. So I've never tried to compete with other people. I'm not a sales guy. I can't do the slick sales presentation. I can just make some things. Hopefully they're clever and I can explain them and I can get really good at makeup. And that's kind of my thing. I don't know how to compete with other people. Like, I find the show's difficult. There's, you know, talking to a lot of people is kind of a little tough. It's kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm just not really a people person, but I find it sort of a bit tough. But then when you start talking to people, you're, they're our people. Like, yeah. It's okay. Like, you're doing this. Oh, okay. And you're doing this. Oh, it's like talking to your brothers or your family, you know? So it's okay. But you're kind of a little bit intimidated by that morning when these people are going to roll up and they're super smart. And I'm the engineering guy and I'm going to be confronted with people doing work. And it's like, well, we're doing the right thing. We're doing this. But I've always had this philosophy. Can we bring more people in? Make the industry bigger. Bring more people in. Bring more people in. I don't have to try to work out and compete with other companies because I just want to bring more people in. And if you look at anything we've ever done in the whole history of our thing, that's the one unifying thing. Is also the other philosophy was the computer guys were sort of trying to kill this industry. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at what they do. And we have to be as good as what they do.
When you say computer guys.
TV people. Like, we want to be television and film people.
Okay.
That are as good as computer companies. But so we're able to actually keep it as because a lot of industries got wiped out by computerization. My feeling was that if we could get really good at it, we could preserve this marketplace of just different innovation and things like that. So that's why DaVinci became quite important because we could do all kinds of different things and, you know, it works with lots of different cameras and stuff. So it created this sort of combined large collection of different, like it's basically a lot of finance people keep coming and hitting us going, oh, you know, we could see consolidation in this industry. It's too much of a cottage industry. It's like, that's exactly what we want. We're all kinds of interesting people doing all kinds of innovations. It's really quite exciting. But the number one thing I've always done is bring more people in. That's what I've tried to do.
Yeah.
And I think we probably sell things sometimes that someone else doesn't get a sale, but what's mostly important is bringing people in. I think we've always stayed focused on that. And I think it's generally worked pretty well, but we've had to do a lot of work to do that. You know, there's huge investments in manufacturing and R&D and all kinds of things, you know. But that's sort of exciting, you know. That's the big thing. So
yeah. And there's a lot of people brought in here. There's 60,000 people, I think, at NAB this year.
Oh, yeah? How much?
So I think over 60,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I also want to do, this is a podcast, but we have the Pixis right here in front of us.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
Want to ask about this camera as well. It is cute.
Yeah.
Just a little guy.
So that's the body. That's the, literally the cube. That's the, is that the L-mount one? I think it is. Yeah, that's the L-mount one. Yeah, that's the L-mount one. So there's three different models. Putting a rechangeable lens mount in it would have made it pretty expensive and heavier. So we wanted to keep it really simple, but it's got to be super strong. We actually made it from aluminum, so it's really strong because you've got mounting points everywhere. In fact, we did this cool thing on the other side where you can change the mounting points here. You can take that off.
Mm-hmm.
And our thinking was we don't quite know. We can put various mounting points in the bottom and top, but we're not sure every kind of mounting. So maybe if we did these plates on the side, you could change them. And people, if we publish the outside shape of that, anyone with a milling machine could mill out different kinds of plates and come up with different things, you know. But the idea is that it's, and the other important thing on this side is having an LCD. That means we can run Blackmagic OS in it. So it's got all the same features. I mean, it's funny, this thing live streams to the client. It's got that. It's got the proxy recording. So it uploads to Blackmagic Cloud. So as you're recording on it, the clips go up to Blackmagic Cloud and come down in any DaVinci that's connected to that project because you can log into the DaVinci project on the camera. So when you're shooting into the project. And it's appearing in the DaVinci systems, and they could be on the other side of the world. So it's just an insane camera. It's picking up everything Blackmagic Ghost can do. It's really cool, you know?
It is awesome.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
So
and again,
it's that
post-production thinking. It's not just a camera. It's connected to this downstream thing. And you can buy a camera, right, and go, oh, this is the cost of the camera. But what happens if you've got to then do a whole lot of work for everything you shoot? But if we can integrate all that and make that less cost as well, it's not just the purchase price of devices. It's also the cost of running them, cost of maintaining them, and you know, and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot more to it than just the product itself. The downstream post-production part, I think, is really important. But that's because I'm a post-production person. So
right.
You're kind of always going to, I mean, our first camera, we kind of screwed the marketing up. We actually if you look at our really original first cinema camera, we basically did post-production marketing for it because we didn't know really enough camera stuff at the time. We knew what we were doing, but they were the engineering guys. But I wasn't sure what the camera people need to know. In fact, after the first day, people had a lot of questions about sensors and that, like, oh, we've got to put that stuff up on our website because they wanted to know a bunch of technical stuff about the sensor, which I just didn't assume. I just thought, oh, it's just a resolution, right? But no, there's all sorts of lens mounts and things like that. I wasn't really aware of how important that was, you know? So, but it turned out to look like it was really innovative. Oh my God, you've done all this post-production aspect of your camera. What an innovation. You guys are so smart. No, we just didn't know. I was a post-production guy. So I just wrote post-production copy, marketing copy. It was just a fluke that it turned out that that was a good thing because we did record ProRes files and we also had like a still photography lens mount and we had a big screen with metadata. So we did all these post-production friendly things and that's always been a theme with the cameras. So
yeah,
it's kind of funny talking about some of this old-fashioned stuff from the early days because you make this sort of screw-up in some ways, but it's innovative because actually that's the one thing a lot of camera people have never done. They never really considered the post-production side. In fact, every camera had weird file formats because we chose post-production formats, the stuff that the editing systems you already used. So you just load the files and go for it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You're pulling it off the lens. You've got like gyroscopes and all kinds of stuff generating. Well, yeah. And then it's funny, right? Because you've got gyroscopes in there. And then, of course, that goes into Fusion. And now you've got that footage winding up in Fusion in a 3D environment back in the planes that it was sort of in the camera. So it's really interesting how all that's sort of hooking up, you know?
Yeah. Was it always the plan to do the Pixis and the Cine at the same time?
Yeah. The thought was that we knew we needed that design in the cinema camera body because you need something handheld, but you also wanted the box camera as well. So we designed them kind of at the same time. I mean, the only thing that's really the same is the sensor board design is kind of similar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're a bit different, but they are, that bit's sort of the same technology behind it. This one's obviously more powerful. It's got a bigger processor and stuff like that, but it's actually a smaller screen on the side. The cinema camera is a bit bigger, but there's a bit more because it's got SDI, so you can have longer cable lengths for your on-set monitoring. It's got two CF Express cards instead of the one because we've got more space. So it's kind of different, but a lot of the code's similar, but they were designed at the same time, yeah.
Nice.
Because that's the thing, you often need the same sensor, but in different bodies.
Right.
But those sensors do match very well because the color science, but yeah. Some of these sets have got pretty high-speed internet on set, so you can plug into the camera and sync really big files really quickly. So, you know, that's a big thing, you know.
So you mentioned Resolve 19 a second ago. Talk a little bit about what you're most excited about or you think indie filmmakers in particular are going to enjoy the most from this.
I mean, it's probably two sides of what I'm excited about. I'm really excited about some of the new film stuff. I mean, what I think I mentioned that in the video. We had to spend a bit of time redesigning all the processing in Resolve. So we threw away a lot of code and rewrote it all. And that took a lot of time, but it meant we now are really fast on the new Apple Silicon and we've got a whole new code base because the CPUs are changing. They're moving to ARM. They're getting away from the Intel standard. So all that code has to be replaced. But there's also new frameworks. We're kind of getting off, what's the architecture? It's like CUDA and things like that. It's now like on the Mac side, it's Metal and some of these other APIs and they're much, much faster. So we've done a lot of that redesign, but it meant we kind of got slowed down a little bit. So we put Fusion into DaVinci and we put Fairlight into DaVinci. And the main thing is we had to, because that was the requisition, so we had to clean up the interface, replace all the code, particularly on Fusion. They only had Windows only, and it was Windows NT kind of code. So we had to replace all that code, rewrite it all. Then we had to get it into DaVinci, which meant that now a lot of people could get access to it, and we could tie it into the timeline. So the clips on the timeline are actually 3D environments in the timeline. So if you double-click one, you go into Fusion, it's in a full 3D environment. So you can look at this edit, it just looks like an edit, but each one of those clips is a full 3D environment. But then we needed to get the USD stuff in there and get all that in there. And we got all that updated. And that was last year. Now we're starting to connect things. And that's what we ultimately wanted to get to. So a good example is you can run a tracker and feed that into the Fairlight audio and it'll move the sound around in 3D space. And you've got a 3D environment in there as well. So you've got this interaction between 3D audio, 3D video, and it all just looks like a timeline. That's an edit timeline. And so I'm really excited about that and some of the AI stuff and how we've got all that working. And the sound, you know, features. But my personal one is I did all the replays. So the replay was all my idea. So that was kind of my baby. And that was the thing I was super nervous about this morning because I've used it. I used it last week on the hockey. That hockey on the front is, you know, what we do. In fact, I didn't use it. The guy that does the hockey used it with me kind of showing him how it worked. Then he got super into the editing. So he was actually distracted with all the editing, but we still did the replays. But it was kind of really cool because it was really working last weekend really well. So yeah, I guess there's two ways. One is the cinema side of all that new stuff, but just this personal side. And obviously it was a little weird doing replay inside DaVinci, but the reason I had the idea is a few months ago or 6 months ago, I was doing some volunteer at for some video stuff, and I was using a replay system. And I was shocked that it couldn't edit. I'm like, it needs to be able to edit. In fact, for a while, I thought the replay could be an edit. If you could edit fast enough, you could use the edit as a replay, but you can't really do that. It's you're filling out time. It doesn't work. But then we kind of came up with more and more features. I thought, I want to be able to use DaVinci for this. I want to be able to use, it'd be a much better replay system. And so that's where we got to with that. But also, I'm really excited by the idea that broadcasters and live production people can get access to film quality processing. Like we did the tennis, and I was playing with the really early prototypes of this replay, not at the tennis, but later after the recording, and using the optical flow processing, which is really a film feature, to create a super slow-mo appearance. And that's all in there. So that was really exciting. So I'm excited with the new film features, but my personal little fun project has been the replay stuff, because those systems are expensive. So actually there's been a lot of demand for a replay system, and I've got to get out the front and see how that's been going. I've been talking to people in the middle of the booth, and I kind of want to get over there and have a look at the replay and see how that's all going.
Especially with your baby.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, actually. Yeah, it's been exciting.
Yeah.
So just those really out there features. Plus, we've got a lot of features that we've been able to do this year. Like we've added network recording to the HyperDeck 4 replay. That's a free update. We're adding 4 channels of recording to the HyperDeck Stream 8K, and that's a free update. We've got 2110 support in the, something we haven't actually announced, but we've got the Ultimate 4K over on the booth. That's running 2110. Got a 10G Ethernet, and that's the Ultimate's already people already have. So we're going to give that for free. The studio camera is going to get 2110, that's free. So we've got all these free updates, which is kind of cool because people can use the products they've already got and they can add these features. That's always a nice thing too. So yeah, there's a lot to be, and the DaVinci update's free. So that's kind of cool, you know, like it's fun, you know.
Very awesome. Well, we're going to do probably a lot more stories around NAB, but cool. I feel we're going to find that AI is a big topic this year, as it was last year at NAB.
Yeah, I think it's one of the problems I think you've got. AI has got obviously an important role, and we've added a lot of it. In fact, we used to call it the neural engine. We've been doing it for a long time.
Right.
But I think one of the problems that tech suffers from at the moment is there's a lot of money being put into tech, and they have no idea what they're putting their money into. So what you're getting is a lot of these fads popping up that demo really well to a finance guy. And business people aren't that bright, right? Business people are some of the stupidest people in the world, and they get fascinated by it. But I don't think they actually know what they're delivering as a product. What's the product? AI. Oh, we're going to have AI. Okay, yeah. But what's the product? Now, if you look at the optical flow in DaVinci, that's an AI algorithm to do the super slow-mo. That's a great purpose for it. And some of the new recognition stuff, that's great too. But I do feel like that we are living in a world now where people just keep trying to find tech fads. And we're going jumping from tech fad to tech fad. Whereas I think the thing we've really focused on is the low-level workflow. What do people actually need to achieve? And then you add the technology when it solves a workflow problem instead of like cloud, for example. Oh, we're going to put everything in cloud. It's like, so if I'm scrolling a clip in a cloud software, every time I scroll it, I've got to download it. Mm-hmm. But if I download a proxy once and onto a storage unit, then I can have 50 people accessing it. I've downloaded the clip once. It seems so logical to me that you only want to download it once instead of 50 times for every single person. But it's just these fads get so out of control sometimes that people stop thinking. So I think the important thing is like, yeah, they're often good ideas, but you've got to integrate them into how are we delivering something that's actually going to make people's workflow better, like the cameras uploading to cloud and all that. That's the way to do it, right? Now you've got clips dropping into your DaVinci bin, and that DaVinci's free. So that becomes very, very powerful. But it is interesting, the number of fads. I find it a very strange time. It's like a few years ago, it wasn't quite like this, but it seems like it's a very kind of like also venture capital fad. It feels like, you know, speed humps you're bumping over the top of. It's like fad, 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 fad.
Right.
And everybody's forgetting the basic workflow of just getting the whole workflow right. And sometimes it's a simple UI thing you've got to change. Like look at the replay. That's one little palette in DaVinci. It opens up a whole replay workflow. And it's not really any particular intelligent technology. It's just a usability thing. It's just the subtlety on how you actually use something. So you got to think it all in balance, I think. It's really easy to jump on. It's, I guess that's, you know, you get people go, oh, I like tech. It's like, what do you like? Well, it's trinkets. It's almost trinkets. They like trinkets or they like little shiny beads. It's quite a fascinating time to, you know, people aren't going very deep. It's very superficial at the moment. So, and look, there is a lot going on. Mm-hmm. So, and it's exciting and it definitely looks thrilling. But I'm really interested in how do you use it? Like, for example, if we look at generative AI, it's mostly a shitty fad. But what I'm really fascinated in generative AI is generating elements in Fusion. You could generate elements in that. You could also generate graphics. But what I'm really fascinated, instead of seeding it with text, you're seeding it with archive film. Because once you can seed it with archive film, you could regenerate it to look like it was shot yesterday. Like I was joking with some of the guys and said, you know, we want to take all those 1960s, 70s and 80s TV shows and repurpose them to make them look like they were shot yesterday.
Yeah.
But we've got to do something with the hair. You're going to have a hair adjustment.
Why would you change the hair?
Because you're going to have like Battlestar Galactica. Part. Remember that in the 80s, yeah. Battlestar Galactica? Imagine if that looked like it was shot yesterday, but the hair gives it away. Oh my God, the hair is terrible. You need like an AI to replace the hair so you can get cool hair. Yeah,
wait,
exactly.
What do the kids like wear these days? The fade? Thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Get
right.
The fade in there.
So the potential for it is awesome, but you got to fix the hair. I don't know. I think that's one of those, that's what's going to be funny about this stuff. People working on it, it's going to be exciting to deal with one problem. You kind of create another, which we've got, like we've repurposed the show. It looks like it was shot yesterday. You can now put that on a streaming platform and everyone will watch it because there's some great old shows, fantastic stories too. If you could update the look, make them letterbox. You could fill out the bits that are missing to make it widescreen. It would look like 8K or even or 4K. But the hair, oh my God. And the fashions are not even that bad, right? Because sometimes it's futuristic stuff.
It's just the hair. Just the 80s you would change. Yeah. You would leave the everything
hair.
Else. Okay.
Yeah, exactly, cool. Right? You just got to deal with the 80s hair. Make it 90s hair, 2000s hair. You need a hair timeline to slide it along. Oh, and basically if it went into tomorrow, you could predict what tomorrow's
hair is
going to
be.
So
that's going to be in DaVinci Resolve so it's got 20, hair. The mullet.
Yeah, it's going to be quite funny, you know? So I think it's going to be, there's a lot of fun, but there's also a lot of bad element to it as well. So
yeah,
I think there's a lot of purpose for it, but it's
I feel like you've answered the question a little bit here, but I know a lot of our audience is very scared about AI. And I think there's a fear that new innovations in different editing softwares are going to like replace their jobs. I wonder, you shared a little bit about this, but how do you see editors staying important in this role and not getting kind of
I don't think that's the case. Like my feeling is that people want to be famous. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to replace people. So people are going to still go out and shoot people because people themselves want to be seen. Like you guys are involved in this, you're in the media.
Yeah.
You want to be seen and you want to do things and it's you doing something and then people are going to watch you doing it. So you could have digital puppet news, but I don't know whether that's going to be exciting. It might be fun. Kids might watch it. And I think the same thing with the editing. It's like, well, you're going to, like there's a lot of fashion-based and editing. And yeah, you could potentially get it to edit, but I don't know. It's just a lot of this technology, it looks like a good idea, but when you look at the cost of it, I mean, DaVinci's free. Would a AI system that's got it going to have to bigger render servers, it's not going to be free.
Right.
So the question is, well, why don't I just do it myself for free? But at the cost of not doing it for free, well, have I saved any money? Because now I've got to have giant racks of servers in some data room churning through this analysis. It's all got to be uploaded, all got to be analyzed, and then put together as an edit. Okay, it could do that, particularly if it could add color correction, maybe a bunch of interesting stuff. So I think there's definitely possibilities in there. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, it's a lot of this technology. I mean, a good example is the US Customs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They used to have these creepy old LED signs with little LED dots, and some of them would get disconnected from the server. So they'd play this weird little demo that obviously when the sign was being sold at the trade show, had a weird little firework effect, digital sign, it would say, you know, because it's disconnected from the mothership and decided that it's just going to do its own little demo program. And it was really cute. You'd come, oh, sign number 14's broken. And it's just running this little demo program to sell the sign. Then they replaced it with these new LED segments, right? Within 6 months, it was all broken, turned off, and it just doesn't get used. So they're all just red. And it's like, that's the new technology that's lasted so little. We have a real problem at the moment. There's a lot of technology just not working. It doesn't work properly. It doesn't last very long. I mean, the building we moved into, it's got those exit signs. It's got a cloud-based monitoring thing. And it's like, and they fails all the time. And the guy's coming, oh, I've got to get to your network. You're not getting to our network. We've got security problems. Blah, but the exit signs, I've lost track of them. Why do you need to monitor the exit sign? In the old days, we'd have a guy walking around every 6 months looking at the exit signs. They all look fine. Now we've got some guy monitoring the exit signs and he's coming in multiple times a month because he's somehow disconnected from the exit signs. So a lot of this technology is just shit and it doesn't work very well. It's not very reliable. So I think a free DaVinci is always going to outgun, you know, X number of $1,000 a week on server farm.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's a lot of guys who want to make a lot of money on server farms. And it's this is, I guess, the problem. There's always these two issues that are going to be connected to humanity. They want the wanting to build something big and expensive because I can make a lot of money. So I've got to try and sell it well enough that everyone thinks they have to use that big service. And there's some validity in using it. Like, for example, Fusion could go into online render farms and get access to as many servers as possible. That's definitely something we could do. But at the same time, and there's always that, you know, so it's getting rich without really doing too much work.
Yeah.
And there's also this, you know, sort of overconfidence in technology and stuff. It's going to somehow just be automatically good. a lot of times it's not working very well and it ends up being easier going back to simple things. Like Toyota, for example, their manufacturing processes use as little computerization as possible. They, you know, they just use cards and things like that. And that process works very, very well because the tech breaks down all the time. So it's an interesting, I mean, how many times have you seen digital signs in the street and they're just, you know, it's a Windows screen or something. They're broken.
Right.
So I don't know, it's interesting. I mean, one of the reasons for doing Blackmagic OS and our own OS, it starts up quickly and it's really reliable because Linux and all these other operating systems are just not very good. They're very slow and they're not very reliable. They've got a lot of code in them that's just really hokey. So I don't know, it's a very complex topic. There's some really exciting stuff. I wouldn't be worried about AI. I think it's fine. It's like everything. It's just, you know, if it gets too smart, it's just another species to kill. I mean, humans are fantastic at killing everything. We eat everything. We kill everything. I don't know what everyone's worried about. Yeah. Oh, so we just got to go hunting computers instead of hunting animals. Either way, we're pretty good at killing things. I wouldn't be worried. I think people worry too much.
If we
we're like
anything,
a dangerous species.
Yeah.
We're dangerous. We're a very dangerous species. Don't worry. It's just another thing to kill. Somewhere there's some gun nuts that will have something to do. Don't worry about it. It'll be fun.
I'm going to say, we've seen several movies about this.
Yeah, and
they're usually unhappy, I think.
Yeah, we know about that. Yeah, cool.
Long enough timeline.
We know to kill Terminator robots. Plus, I don't think those Terminator robots were killing normal people. They're going after real estate agents and stuff. I think normally they've probably got houses next door. Probably come around and borrow some sugar. Like, oh, did you kill anyone last night? Yeah, we killed some real estate agents. I did that eye thing. Freaked them out. You know, I ran over some skulls. It was awesome. But that was across town. You know, over here, but can I borrow your lawnmower? I don't know. I'm not sure how it works, but I don't think
I think that's exactly how
it's all
work.
Normal.
Yeah.
That's just what they get up to at night. It's always night. So
just
what do they do during the day?
Now,
during the day, they like take their kids to school like every normal Terminator robot would. It's fine. Yeah. Don't worry. You know? So anyway, that was probably going a little bit too far. But, you know.
Suck up to him now.
Yeah, that was a classic episode, wasn't it? Was that the space one when they went to space? Yeah. And he goes, how's the mission? He goes, I don't know. All this stuff's just for measuring ratings. That's like, don't you love that?
That's awesome. All right. Well, I want to wrap things up here. I do want to ask one last question. And it's just kind of about your thoughts on the future of Blackmagic design. What's maybe on the roadmap? What are you excited about to kind of dive into next after these new cameras just kind of got announced? And if we're at NAB 2025 here, how have things changed? You might anticipate.
Well, it's always, we don't really talk about future stuff because, I mean, you'd be surprised the number of things we pulled from shows when you think you've got something and you really pull it. So it's always a bit hard to tell exactly which direction things are going. But I mean, we've got a lot of ideas, a lot of stuff floating around, a lot of, you know, technology we're working on. It's just hard to talk about it really. But I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's pretty exciting. But people really forget how much skill is involved in using these tools. Okay. Like sometimes people say, oh, you know, I can download color correction. Yeah, but it's a lot of skill in it. Not only that, you've got to become attuned to color of things. Like you look at things and it's like, oh, that looks like something. I remember one day I was leaving work years ago and the guy I used to work with, the Harry operator, it shows how long ago it was. He looked at the sky and he goes, oh, you get a good key off that sky. And I'm like, oh yeah, you would. And he goes, my boss said that to me once and I've never been able to look at a blue sky the same. I'm like, shit. And he goes, you've just done the same thing to me. Now when I look at a blue, look, oh, you get a good key off. Except the good thing is we use green screen now, not blue screen.
Right.
So that's changed. But it's kind of like funny. You got to become that. It's like the replay system, right? We developed this replay system. We sit down and we start to use it and we're like, oh, we don't know how to use it. Like, it's really bizarre. Yeah. You invent something, but you realize what you've actually invented is not a workflow. You've invented a collection of features. And each one of those features could be used. But then you realize, well, you kind of need to use it a different way than you expected. And you start learning, you realize, well, that's the problem. One, I don't know hockey very well, not as good as the guys who do it. But secondly, I actually don't know how to use our replay system. There's ways of doing it. And in different situation, just even yesterday on the booth, I was playing with it. And it was a fight broke out because that hockey match, it was 11-2. And so one side gets overconfident, the other sides get frustrated, and they just fight. So here I am doing it. And then I realized the fight broke out. I'm like, well, I don't want to replay into the fight, but I've got one camera on the fight. Now I need to switch cameras. And we've got this feature where you can change the camera numbers.
Uh-huh.
So in the replay, you can switch between the cameras as it's replaying. You don't have to like cue the next shot back again. You can do that. So I'm just switching between the two cameras. Now I'm literally doing a live switch of a delayed slow motion replay. I thought, oh, yeah, this actually becomes really important. So I knew the feature was in there, but now I'm understanding the creative context of why I need to use it. Exactly. And I realized, oh, there's a creative connection to what I'm doing. So while I understood all the functionality, what I'm discovering now is the connection between what's happening and how I need to use it to react to that. And then how long, and then I really got to be in tune to the fact that the game's going to start again. So I've got to come out of the replay in time. And there's a lot of things going on. One of the cameras moved out of focus. So I've got to change cameras. So it's really a fascinating, it's quite a fascinating process to learn how to actually use your own product. And that's the thing I think people underestimate. Even a product looks fairly simple. There's actually a lot of technique and how to use it. And there's a lot of knowledge in that. So I think that,
yeah, exactly.
And that is the big truth is how do you start? Like, how do you, if you're starting out in color, the minute I move a trackball, I get lost and I just freak out. And I'm like, so I can do some gains. But literally the minute I start moving trackballs, I freak out and get it wrong. Then I get it wrong again. I get it wrong again. But on the eight, on the color panel, you know, the camera control panel, I got red, green, and blue knobs. So I can just put a bit of red or a bit of green, blue. I don't touch green, and I'm kind of okay to do it on that. But on the trackball, because I got 2 degrees directions of movement, I always kind of get lost. And I've got lift game again, so I get lost in that. So I'm a terrible colorist. But I respect, because of that, how good a colorist really is. Because one of the things I've felt about DaVinci, which we did a couple of years ago, is that there's all these extra adjustments in the primary color corrector. I felt like people were too quickly running into secondaries or running into curves. But you can do a lot in the primary, especially when you're trying to create film stocks. If you want to emulate a film stock or create some kind of 1950s look, you can do a lot with the trackballs, of course. But then there's all these other functionalities. Like a good example is you've got saturation, but you've also got color boost. Well, color boost boosts the color where it's low, but anything that's saturated keeps constant. Whereas saturation just runs all the saturation up and down. So I felt like, well, that means color boost is a much better saturation control than saturation is. So I thought, well, we should have those knobs up on the panel. Then you can adjust them and then people start to play with them and go, well, what's that do? Oh, because they don't really think about what it does technically. They think about what it does creatively. Like, oh, when I adjust this knob, oh, it does that. If the knobs are there, I felt like they're going to get used. But if they're hidden in the UI, then no one really ever clicks on them and tries them. And I felt like it was, exactly, yeah, because you've got to look for it and know what it is before you know what it is. Exactly. Then no one ever bothers. Like I had an old colorist friend and I said, oh, have you ever used, like, what do you use all these extra primary controls for? And she said, oh, I just use the trackballs. I'm like, well, she doesn't use it. But then when she had the panel, she started playing with it and you realized, oh, she's exploring the knobs because the knobs are there. So exactly, yeah. So we pulled up all those primary color correction controls that were not really on the panel. They are on the really big panel, but that's high-end colorists can use those, you know. But we put them up on the panel. So we kept that because that was really nice.
Accessibility once again.
Yeah, but the shift buttons are really good because you can now reframe and move windows around. You can add windows. You can add nodes. And so it's a, I think it's a really good redesign. But the main thing is this slots for an iPad. So you can see an iPad in there. My thinking about the iPad is we picked up the iPad kind of for free because we did all the processing work. Mm-hmm. We changed all the frameworks. We took all the old APIs out, which meant we had code that could pretty much port to iPad because that is the iPads have always had those modern architectures. But the UI was a problem because it's a small screen and also there's less memory. So we had to do some optimizations for memory usage. But we got that worked out. If the screen gets smaller, because you want it the same version on the iPad to what you have on the desktop, otherwise it's just a different product. But right. As you reduce the screen size down, some of the buttons turn into menus, so you can click on them. And so that way you still have all the functions there. You just have to click on a menu. And so that worked. And then we got it on the iPad. But my feeling is, okay, what's the advantage of an iPad? I can see the disadvantage. You can't mouse over things. But what's an advantage of an iPad? Well, it doesn't have a keyboard. So the thinking is, well, I can add a keyboard back and that's that. So that in the iPad is a laptop, but it's a laptop without a keyboard. It's a laptop with a color panel. So that's my feeling that the advantage in iPad is no keyboard. Now, normally keyboard's a great advantage, but if you don't have a keyboard, we provide the keyboard designed for color correction. Now you have the perfect color correction station. I mean, you could be over the other side of the world. We could be sitting here and I could have someone back in another country doing a job. They could share the job with me. I can select it. It'll download the proxies. I can start color correcting. And as I'm color correcting, those color grades are going back to the originals and changing the grades. And the editor's version of the job in another part of the world.
Yeah.
That's why the knobs are lower. Notice how they're lower knobs than we did on the other panels. And also the ATEM mini panel, which we did, has also got a fader, not a T-bar, because it's also low profile. Because these wind up in backpacks. People throw them in their backpack. They go on holiday, they drop it in their suitcase, drop their iPad in, they go on holiday, and someone calls them and says, hey, look, can you color grade this job? I got a problem. I need you to color grade the job. And you're like, yeah, you pull the panel out, pop the iPad in. It's got mobile data. You hook into Blackmagic Cloud, get access to the job because they shared it with you, color grade it all up. An hour later, you're back beside the pool. Or, you know,
it's accessibility.
Exactly.
Once again.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, if you're at like a convention, perhaps in Vegas, and you want to do some iPad
exactly
color
right.
grading.
Yeah, you're in a hotel. I mean, last year, the guys who did the ice hockey came to the show, but the ice hockey season's on now in Australia. So they did the they did the control of this of the ice hockey from the hotel room. They live streamed the multi-view and they connected the panel remotely. And there's no one in the control room back in Melbourne, but they're doing the control of the ice hockey, which I thought was extraordinary. Like, that's nuts, but they did it. And that was because they didn't want to miss the match.
I just thought that it doesn't feel like it's going to break if you throw it into a backpack.
Yeah. And it's also, if you look at it, if you pull the ring up, it's got a proper roller bearing. See, that's a proper roller bearing. And we changed the lubricant in the roller bearing to make it the right consistency, to make it the right sort of rotational, what would you call it, tension or whatever viscosity, I suppose. And I just, and the balls just come out and clean them. So, yeah, it's really
nice. If this is a podcast,
and it's completely designed.
Green is taking apart.
Oh, that's true. I can't show you the roller bearing. Maybe I'll put it up near the microphone and spin it real fast.
Yeah.
But it's quite funny, isn't it?
This will turn into an ASMR video.
So we really didn't compromise on the quality at all. And also we've got, I think, 12 different languages of the keyboard as well. We've also, all the normal languages we do, but also I think Vietnamese and Thai we picked up as well, because I think we have some people in-house that know that language. Because we're always adding extra languages, so we translate everything to the languages.
Nice.
So, it just makes it so...
Yeah, but you can feel the buttons are really nice.
But it's just, I just love the idea of, like, as someone who is on the go all the time, or, like, that workflow, and, like, you want to be getting content.
Yeah.
You want to be getting
stuff. Exactly.
And this allows you to not just have, like, this allows you to have high-end deliverables.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Because you're pulling the proxies down, doing the grade, but the person with the main job is getting those grades back.
Yeah.
They can render out for you. And I think one of the other problems, people don't realize how hard everyone works in this industry. People do not, like, have personal time in this industry. Like, I know people, you know, that in this industry that have worked 16-hour days and they're still doing it. And so, you know, if you can go on holiday, because I guess the problem you've got in this industry is people depend on you. And if you're not available because you've gone on a month holiday,
they'll find someone else.
Well, now you've kind of, they find someone else. And now that person has become, that's how most of us actually made it, right? Most, there was that one day when the guy was sick, you stepped in and you solved the problem. Or, you know, in my case, I fixed something that the boss wasn't around. And now people have confidence in you. And so you feel like if you don't keep going, then people are going to lose confidence in you and the work dries up. Just getting enough confidence through the industry of the people you know to keep consistent work coming in was a major achievement in our younger years. You don't want to damage that. But it means you kind of can't get any time off because you've got to be available. I think lawyers have the same problem. Lawyers have to be available at any time. So it makes it hard to have a work-life balance. If you can go on a holiday and bring that with you, they don't actually know that you're not available. You are available. You do the color grade in a hotel room and get back to having a holiday. But you can kind of integrate some of that. But because you just don't want to be not available. I think it's really a problem if you're not available.
And
so
it's just too. Like, it fits both it scales. You know what I mean? So, like, this, even on your own, like, making your own stuff.
Yeah.
It's like you can take it as the filmmaker.
That's true. In fact, one of the things I'm hoping to do is get better at color grading.
Yeah.
Because now I've got this little panel because I've got one at home and I just want to be better at using it. You know, like
I didn't know the color boost thing. And now I'm
I know.
That's
a hot tip. And there's all kinds of other ones and you sort of, you know, luckily I can talk to the Da Vinci guys and find out. Because a couple of these come from the original Da Vinci.
Available, so,
like, there's some Y adjustments and things. Like, the Y adjustments I find fascinating in Da Vinci. Like, Da Vinci's YRGB. And I said to them, why is it YRGB? Why you got this Y channel? Because technically you can make the Y channel from the RGB. They said, well, their reason was if you change the color of something, or like if you're adjusting the color, it doesn't affect the gain. Normally when you're color grading on RGB, you've got to, you know, you add some more green, and because the balance of the way the white's created from the RGB, that changes the gain level. So then you've got to kind of match the gain. So you're chasing yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
With this, you can tint something and the level stays the same. So I thought, well, that's a nice technical reason. But one thing I really liked is that, like, a good example, I was watching a show and they pulled I know it was graded on Vinci, and there was these guys with lab coats and they pulled the whites out and those lab coats radiated. Or, like, you know, washing powder commercials and things where they always have a lot of clean whites and things like that. You can make the whites pop. I'm fascinated with that Y channel, just using it creatively. So we put the YRGB color corrector in the cameras. So the studio cameras and everything have that. And you can adjust that. And some people get some amazing looks out of that. It's such a simple thing, but it's really quite nice.
That's like the homework from today's interview. Yeah. It's like, start playing with
that. Go and have a look. Yeah. Good thing there's a lot of videos around now of how to use all this stuff. So it's just fascinating. There's not enough hours in your lifetime to learn as much as I'd love to learn. You know, I know a lot about all these products, but once I start trying to create color looks, I get out of my depth. And the audio side is another area where, you know, I'd like to be better at Fairlight. Like, I'd just love to be better at that. So, you know, even within our product lines, I'm like, which is great because I've, you know, someone else can do the DaVinci demo video, and I can just show maybe one or two bits that I've been involved in. But it's quite funny, like how many things we make that I've got to learn more on. So, like, if you get a chance, you know, it's quite funny.
And you're giving people like an insight onto what to learn. Like, you're giving them a hint by putting the labels there. You're like, maybe you should explore color boost, or maybe you should.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of really, there's a lot you can do on the primary corrector. I really like the primary corrector. It doesn't have any regional stuff, and just there's so much you can do with it. It's so easy again to run off and use all the gadget type features like curves and things like that. But there's a lot of the look. And to me, the look is the emotion of a shot.
Yes.
So I really like the connection between the primary color corrector and the emotion of a shot. You can get in and make things accurate. I can get in and see those bushes over there, the green that we, you know, near the distance. You can put windows on those and tweak them around. But that's not really the emotion of the shot. The primary corrector is where the emotion is. So I really find that to me very interesting. And to me, that's what color correction is. It's emotion. You know, you've got sound and video, and that's very technical, but this heart stuff is the color correction part of that. So I find that I've always loved, the minute I've worked in the very first post house, I walked into the color correction room and I was looked at the picture on the monitor. I was just almost took my breath away. I'd never seen a picture look so good because it was RGB. It was a Telecine scanning. And the colorist had left the room. So when we went in there, the colorist wasn't in there because he was just transferring something down. So he'd gone off to have a cup of coffee, and there's just this Telecine was rolling, and it was going into this BVM monitor, and it was RGB, and it just looked so beautiful. I remember just looking at it going, I've never seen anything like this before. It just unbelievably blew my mind. And that was the moment I fell in love with color correction. And I used to hang out in the color correction suites to the level of annoying everybody. But then I could just keep asking questions. And so I remember I worked with one guy, there were people say, oh, this guy's really, all the engineers, he's, oh, he's really harsh. And, you know, but I used to love this guy because all he wanted was someone to talk to him properly and with respect. And I could find out, because once you start talking to them, they'd start telling you stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is gold. Yeah. You know, like one of the problems I think we all suffer nowadays is because so many people can start out from nothing. Mm-hmm. They don't have mentors. You know, there's all the expertise. And like in manufacturing, I had to learn it all myself. I didn't have a mentor to tell me anything, which sometimes make, now we have guys we've hired, but it's just so lonely when you're first starting out.
I like that in the industry. And I think it's fun. That's why I was saying, like, you have the insights on there.
Yeah.
Pick that up. Never touch up, but it's always wanted to.
Yeah.
This doesn't look as daunting, first of all.
Yeah, that's true, actually. And yeah, that's a point.
Putting insights on what they should explore.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, well, what is color vision? Yeah. What is that? Whereas they would never go into
it. Exactly. And that's the good thing about YouTube. At least that could be a mentor.
Yes, yeah.
Like the people on there can be a mentor, which is great. The man, it can be lonely at certain points when you're trying to do, especially if you're trying to do something, there is no videos on YouTube. We always forget that the stuff on YouTube is stuff that people know that people need to know about. Right. But there's a lot of time when you want to try something new and there is no one really going to show you how to do that, but you're trying to go down some kind of path and you don't know. And that's when it gets lonely. And that's actually what creativity is. So I think with creativity is also great loneliness because you're out there on an edge that nobody really understands. You're trying something and it might come off or it might not. A lot of times it doesn't.
Right.
But it's kind of a lonely feeling. I guess it's not as lonely when everyone's telling you everything you're doing is wrong. But, you know, is it? I'm fascinated by the idea that something's a failure or it's not successful yet. I find that they also look the same. But that sometimes it's that confidence in an idea that takes it through from being not successful yet to successful. But in these modern times, it's easy to criticize. People kill things before they even get a chance to try it. So it's a fascinating, there's so many flaws in the way humans think. It's quite interesting, you know?
But but the Blackmagic design approach, I think, comes to you because it's like, you know that world and you know how to make it accessible for a community.
Yeah.
Regardless of the budget inherently involved, they're going to be able to pick up that and be excited about growing with the company.
And I'm personally, the thing I never forget, there's two things I never forget. One is that people at 1 a.m. are still working.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I'm terrified of the customers from the point of view that I'm going to fuck this up. Oops, sorry, I just swore. Because
yeah, no,
if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
the people that are using this gear are extremely talented.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm somewhat in awe and terrified at the same time.
If I ask you that one question, you're like,
yeah, well, it's not even that. It's just because if I don't know the answer, I'll ask them.
Yeah.
So that's why if you notice my videos, I just sort of say what we've done. I'm not going to say it's great. I don't know if it's great. How could I know that?
Let me know.
I'm going to find out pretty soon, you know, because we're going to roll up at a show and people are going to kick my ass if it's wrong or tell us in great detail why it's wrong. And I'm like, well, I don't quite. Because also the other times you're trying to do something new, they might not be right because, like, well, it's kind of this is not what I'm trying to do. This. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but I just think that it's interesting. Literally 6 months ago, I got to make a decision on some technical thing or something that you got to be ruthless and not care about what anyone thinks. But at the same time, what you're trying to create, you want people to love.
To appeal.
So yeah. You've got to be simultaneously ruthless and simultaneously full of empathy.
Yeah.
Like it's maybe like a surgeon when they cut into you to fix you. They've got to be absolutely ruthless about cutting you. I mean, they're cutting someone.
Yeah.
That's insane how someone can get through that mentally.
Yeah.
And then they can get in there with all that smushy stuff and fix whatever's wrong
yeah.
and then sew it all up and go, I did a good job.
Yeah.
Like I remember we did teppanyaki. Like it's amazing the worlds people live in. We went to teppanyaki for our wedding anniversary, you know, and we're there and the guy's all happy and he's like, oh, so what are you celebrating? And we're like, oh, it's our wedding anniversary, 20th, and kids are all there. So then I turned to the boy and I said, it'd be funny if, there's a couple young couple and they're all happy celebrating their wedding anniversary. Then they turn to the next guy and he's dressed up a warlord and he says, well, I burned a village. And I, like, you know, 15 people. Like, I don't know, does Putin go to teppanyaki after he's put a missile into an apartment block? I kind of feel like he probably does. So I kind of thought, so the boy's laughing because like it's so stupid. And then you go back and it's like, oh, so the young couple, they go, we bought a new cat. And then it's back to the warlord guy who's just done some other horrific atrocity. Like I think the idea of someone celebrating something really bad is kind of funny. And this is probably getting a little off topic, but I just think the funny thing about this creativity is that you're ruthless and empathetic combining. And I find that really funny and a bizarre way of thought is this, two ways of thinking about being ruthless. I've been making all these decisions and I can roll up to the show the day before the show. I'm sitting there going, I'm about to, like, this is going to, like, we're going to be confronted with every one of these decisions. Oh my God, we'll be careless, like, about what we chose to do. Like, well, that panel's 8 months old. We had rubber buttons on it and we hated them. The minute we started using it, it's like, these are horrible.
Oh, interesting.
So we got to fix the buttons. So we didn't ship it, like, last NAB or whatever, because we spent most of last year just redesigning the buttons and they're backlit. And we wanted that nice scissor mechanism. Remember the old one that they used to use on computer keyboards and all that? We had to go through a whole lot of work to redesign it. But now we have these beautiful backlit buttons. And when you push them, they're quite large buttons.
It's a tactile sense that feels...
Yeah, when you push them, they're quite large, but they go down evenly. They don't rock. So all this sort of stuff. And then doing the backlighting and all that kind of stuff to... Because you can't use a computer keyboard button because they have a LED on them. They're not backlit.
Yeah.
But the button's in the middle. This button is all around the button. So the mechanism is around the light. The LED's in the middle to backlight it. So... You're making these decisions and thinking, when you roll up at the show, it's like, oh, I'm about to really confront the realities of those decisions because you make them somewhat blasé and somewhat ruthlessly. And then you wind up, particularly with, say, Da Vinci and user interfaces and things like that. And you wind up at the show thinking, oh my God, I hope we've kind of made the right decisions. And then you kind of feel quite nervous that you're going to confront what you did and find out that you were ruthless without care versus ruthless to make decisions quickly, but with empathy.
Yeah.
And I find that a really interesting, so the warlord joke was funny, but the idea of that dual way of thinking, you know, I think it's kind of fascinating, you know, like, because how do you think about thinking? Most people don't bother. So I find it interesting the way we think. Like I was saying to the guys, you know, a dog hangs its head out the window of a car thinking this is fantastic. Humans are awesome. It can no way comprehend the code that's running the computer, the magnetic fields around the motors, what's going on, how the metal was created.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's realities that we can't comprehend that it's so easy to understand if something was smarter, but we can understand the world we can understand. We think we understand the scientific process, so we know everything that can be known, but I'm fascinated by the idea that there'll be stuff that isn't known.
Like
it's not knowable to us. Exactly. Yeah. Now everyone worries about artificial intelligence becoming super smart, but the problem is it's always been created by us. So I don't know how it would become smarter than what we are.
Right.
Because it can't comprehend what because we created it.
It's becoming more and more. Yeah, we're.
I mean, maybe if we were smarter, we'd go, of course you can just walk through a wall. If you knew more, like that, you know, like a dog doesn't understand. We don't understand because there's a limit to our capability.
Yeah.
And maybe the AI won't ever be smarter than we are because we created it.
Yeah.
So it can and never comprehend. Exactly. So even if it gets smarter at computing things and it can do things faster and bigger and process pixels or whatever, it just can't have a deeper level of understanding than we are because we created it. So I don't know, it's quite fascinating. So then I think, well, we've got so much freedom to create products, we'd better think it through deeply because people's lives, they make money off our products, they create businesses based on their products. We better be seriously focused on that to make sure that we don't stuff people's businesses up. So it makes you worry a lot about the way you think about things and the way we should be doing things, but at the same time, you've got to be ruthless and make decisions. But then with empathy. So there's different ways of thinking, I find. And business people do not think in any way anything like the right way to think. And I think I feel like our business is run very much the same as all our customers run their businesses. It's all about creativity, getting it done, and we kind of the same thing, and it's just culturally similar, I guess. I don't know.
That's awesome. So. I think we're at time.
Sorry, I'll keep talking all day. That's the problem. Like, once I get going.
No, this is great.
Sorry to keep talking.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for sitting and chatting with us.
No worries.
Thank you so much for tuning in. You can get more NAB coverage at nofilmschool.com. We'll be continuing our conversation on the podcast about the things that came out of the conference and what it means to filmmakers like you. You can get more No Film School at nofilmschool.com, of course, and you can like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast across all platforms. You can also follow us on social media. If you're getting anything out of these conversations, please tell your friends. We'd love to bring in more listeners to grow our community and make more movies, ads, commercials, TV, you name it. We're here for you. Thanks.